I just want to let people know that we're speaking with Elizabeth Jarrett Andrew, author of Swinging on the Garden Gate, a spiritual memoir, which has just been re-released. So before we get into the meat of the spiritual memoir part, well, yes, the spiritual memoir part, could you explain briefly to people the difference between a memoir and an autobiography, and what makes your memoir a spiritual memoir?
Absolutely. Yeah, so a memoir is, well, actually, it's easier to start with autobiography. An autobiography is a document that narrates a life. It usually is thorough. It begins at the beginning and gives a full accounting of the events of the life, progresses chronologically. Autobiographies are often considered historical documents. They're straight nonfiction. Memoir, on the other hand, is a personal narrative that can begin wherever it wants to and end wherever it wants to. It's usually thematically organized. And memoir usually has, you know, even though you're telling a true story about your life, it's usually organized around some question or theme. And so it's looking through the events of your life at some philosophical question or some exploration about life, the nature of the nature of life itself. So a spiritual memoir has the spiritual life as its theme, and so that's what's the organizing principle for my memoir.
And could you start with a little reading for us?
Sure. Yeah, I thought I would read the opening pages of the book. Every story begins with a word, a daunting word, a word that mars the blank white page or inks the air. A word has upright bones and sinews. It's created the way a body is created, from dirt and spit. It walks about relating to other words until it is a part of an extended thought or metaphor or entire narrative telling how the world began. The world began in chaos like a rough draft. It began with the faith that creation is good. Once I carried within me a word so potent that it spread through every artery and vein until my tongue swelled with silence. I carried it into the faculty lounge at the middle school, where conversation ranged from marriage to the two-car garage. The word sat rock hard in my stomach beside the cafeteria lunch I wolfed down in 22 minutes. I carried it with me through the corridors where one student called another queer and sent me raging, dragging him into the classroom by his shirt sleeve. Angled against the blackboard, arms crossed, he defied me with his eyes. My red-faced fury didn't go far. I forced down the real word and ranted instead about inappropriate behavior and put-downs. I carried it with me through 3 years of semester reviews with my principal as we hassled over the inclusive range of paperbacks on my classroom shelves. She was always cordial. The books that passed muster were those that didn't make any waves. Sitting before her wide desk, the boundaries of my body became retaining walls, while inside raged the tidal wave of a word. I carried my word into Sunday worship with a liberal congregation in the heart of Minneapolis. Adult education that morning was a panel discussion on bisexuality. Should the church's statement of intentional welcome include bisexuals alongside gays and lesbians? My eyes widened as several people described their experiences of being drawn to men and women and made a case for celebrating the expansive diversity of God's creation. The word inside me turned restless and eager. I wanted to grow on my spiritual journey, to move forward after years of stasis, and I had a hunch that speaking my word would set me in motion. I was terrified. Coming out in any form cracks the world open. When we come out, we take a buried truth, an inward reality residing near the soul, and pull it to the surface where it wreaks havoc on every perpetuated falsehood. We yank a piece of our existence out into the air, transforming in the process the self we thought we were, as well as the community around us. I came out bisexual, claiming with pride God's presence in the unique desires of my body. But as soon as I could recognize incarnation within my own skin, it was everywhere else as well, in my past, in the landscape, in each object, in the story itself. The middle school where I taught seventh grade English couldn't accept my word. But thank heavens, my church did, and now the religious contingent marching in the Pride Parade is one person longer, larger. Where the word is spoken, the huge creaking wheels of creation begin to turn.
That's Elizabeth Jarrett Andrew reading from Swinging on the Garden Gate, a spiritual memoir. This is being re-released right now. Am I right about that?
It is, yeah. It came out in July.
Can I ask how long ago you wrote it first?
Yeah, well, I started writing it in 1992 and it was published in 2000. So this is its 22nd anniversary of being out. And I'm really excited that it's out again. When it had been out of print for a while, and when it was approaching the 20th anniversary, I thought, you know, it bugs me that it's not out and about in the world because it did really good work for a while. And so I plan to self-publish it a second, you know, this time. But just on a whim, I contacted my editor at Skinner House and I said, any chance you'd be interested in reissuing it? And she and the board conferred and they decided actually they think that it's more timely today than it was 22 years ago. And so they wanted to give it another shot. So I feel really excited by that and a little sad actually.
Sad? Because, why sad?
Well, because it means that, you know, there's actually just as few books out there about bisexuality and spirituality as there were 22 years ago. And that's, you know, in some ways things have really changed, in other ways they haven't. So I'm just glad that my book can be a voice to explore that intersection.
And coming out bisexual really is the through line. I'm wondering, wondering what inspired you to write this in the beginning, such a long time ago. It seems to me it would have been a very difficult thing to be facing to come out like this in a book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I came out first in my relationships, but actually that's not true because I'm a writer and I write to find out what I think and feel. And so I was writing this story as a way to understand myself. And so in many ways, I wrote myself out of the closet. Then I came out of the closet. I hadn't shared the writing with anyone. Although when I came out to my parents, I also handed them a bunch of pages. So really it was a way for me to reach clarity about myself and kind of revisit my past. You know, whenever you realize something new about yourself that's been true all along, you kind of have to go back and rewrite your past memories in light of that truth. And so this book was a way for me to do that. And then at some point it was no longer about self-discovery, but about making a whole, making a unity of my experience and really wanting to explore what it means to be embodied spirit, especially in this bisexual body. So that's when it leapt out of the personal realm into what I think is really a bigger conversation than a book.
And who did you want your audience to be? Who were you thinking of when you wrote it? Bisexual folks who needed help coming out, or just the world in general who needed some education? Or what was your audience, did you feel?
Well, my first audience was my younger self. I wrote for that young woman who was alone and frightened and confused, and so in some way that I was in conversation with my former self, and I believed that there are many aspects of that younger self that are out and about in the world, and that there would be readers who carry those aspects to some degree. So I was writing for them. But then, as I got deeper into the revision process, and it became more than just a personal memoir, I was thinking about my parents and all parents of queer people who, especially if you're raised in Christianity, there's a lot of bad doctrine out there, hard doctrine out there, that it takes some theological astuteness, I suppose, to understand how you can be Christian and believe that you're made in God's image, and be bisexual. So I was thinking about parents of queer people, but mostly, and then certainly in the reprint of it, I was thinking about this, these younger generations of people, queer people who feel very alienated from the church, from religion in general. I was one of the impetuses behind republishing was I was asked by a couple of Wisconsin two-year colleges to come and speak to their GLBTQA groups, and at both of those colleges, I was asked by young people in the audience, "Is it possible to be queer and Christian? Is it really possible to be queer and spiritual?" And those questions just were wrenching to me. I mean, just that there's such a divide between queer identity and faith, or spirituality. Like every human being has a spiritual dimension, and faith is a given. It's like part of being human. Whether it's a traditional religious faith or not, we all have faith because we all orient ourselves in the world. So to be that removed from that dimension of your humanity is just tragic. And I think that that's really the fault of a Christianity and not just Christianity, but many religions that have re ejected, rejected the their queer members. And then, as a result, the queer communities have been ardently anti-faith and ardently secular. And so there's quite a rift between those communities. So I really wanted to see this book out in the world because it's a dialogue between both aspects that are really integral to who I am, and I think who we all are, right? We all are sexual beings, and we all have a dimension of faith and spirit. So how do they intersect, and how do we understand them? And this is just my understanding.
What was it like to come out to your church, and how did they respond and accept you or not accept you? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, I have a really unusual story because I picked my church after I graduated from college. I joined a church, and I picked it because it was reconciling. Because I think I, in some part of my subconscious, knew that I was going to explore my sexual identity, and I write in the book about this early adult education session that I attended. They were already welcoming of gays and lesbians, and they were wondering, should we intentionally welcome bisexuals and transgender people into our congregation? And so they had a panel of bi and trans people speaking about their faith stories, and they were the most remarkable people. It was so inspiring, and I can't really believe this, but I think that was the first time I ever heard the word bisexual spoken out loud and owned. And when the bis on that panel described their experiences, I thought, that's it. So in some ways, I learned about bisexuality from my church. And when I stood up in I actually came out in Joys and Concerns, which is this part of Methodist worship where the congregation offers its prayers. And when I stood up and came out bisexual to my congregation, everyone was super happy and welcoming. And so I have a very unusual story that way. And then it gets even more unusual because even though my parents had a hard time at first, it was a really big adjustment. Eventually, my mom became a leader in the reconciling movement in the United Methodist Church, which is a movement to get the United Methodist Church to change its GLBTQA policies. So she became a real activist. And yeah, I was awfully proud of her. So I think because of that, because I have really a d very different experience from what the vast majority of queer Christians experience, I do feel some obligation to share my story and to share how significant it has been to be nurtured and loved by a church. Just as a model for what's possible, and I think what's right.
How did writing the memoir change you? It took many years, and I'm sure your spirituality changed and perhaps matured over that time.
Yeah, very much so. I wrote my way out of the closet. I feel like I wrote my way into my voice. There's something about writing a memoir that really helps you integrate and get perspective on whatever the topic is that you're exploring. And I before that, I was shy, not very confident, and very, yeah, kind of a quiet person. And writing the memoir kind of put some pieces together internally for me that really allowed me to stand up and own my story publicly, use my voice more confidently, and be more of a public presence. So in some ways, like the book itself was not the success of the book, not the publishing of the book, but the writing of the book, the figuring things out through the writing became a platform that I could really stand on. And that's really been true ever since that it just kind of the end result was that I knew myself better. And that's a significant thing that has consequences that continue to play out for me.
There's so many parts of your story. I'm thinking about your bike trip through Wales, which we won't talk about. Well, let's talk about that. How did that change you? Did that bring you closer to your God, traveling on a bike through Wales, or did it make you less lonely or more lonely? How did that affect you?
Yeah, so I spent a month biking alone, and I was 21 at that time, and I had never done anything like that before. In fact, I had hardly spent any time alone. I may not have spent any time at all alone until then, actually, now that I think about it, maybe a day or two here and there, but it was in many ways my first retreat. And there's something powerful about deep solitude, especially for a young person who hasn't experienced it. So that trip was, I also was completely inexperienced at traveling by myself. I was inexperienced at getting exercise. I had no muscles whatsoever. And so I set off on this bike ride in the mountains, woefully unprepared. And so So what was interesting about it was as I strengthened my body, as I learned to be, to move through loneliness. I was incredibly lonely, especially at first, but I learned to move through loneliness to solitude and kind of a place of peace with solitude. I built the muscles in my body. And then in that solitude, I faced some real fear, fear of being a woman on the road alone, fear of the natural elements. I slept through a terrible storm on the coast and pushed the limits of my body. And so I learned a lot about myself. And in that solitude, I had space to, I had been in a relationship with a guy before that, and I had space in that solitude to ask the hard questions that I couldn't ask when I was in the middle of that relationship and really listen to my desires. And so I learned a lot about who I am on that trip.
Cool. Let me check out something with Annie. Annie, are you there?
I sure
She's
am.
not
What's
there.
up?
I was thinking maybe we could just keep on going to the top of the hour since we got started late. I'll just keep going until somebody yells at me to
Oh,
stop.
keep going. We don't have anything planned for the other half of the hour, so please just keep going.
Oh, okay, great. I wanted to especially talk to you about the time that you were in the faith community, and especially when you first got there, how you lost everything you've owned in a fire. And I'm wondering how that affected your relationship with God, and if you got mad or sad, or what you thought about God after that happened.
I'll preface my answer by saying that I'm not, or at least at that point, and certainly today, I wasn't someone who thinks that God can kind of intervene with kind of the natural law, physical laws, and make things happen. So, or intervene and not make things happen. And certainly that kind of deus ex machina God is not something that I am personally familiar with. I mean, certainly it's out in the culture. So when the fire happened, I mean there so basically I had all my belongings stored in the garage, and the garage burned because of a faulty ignition in the car. And it was a huge fire. So when that happened, like it was a period of terrible grief because I lost all my writing, I lost all my photos, I lost, really important gifts like my grandmother's afghan and quilt from my mom, and so some terrible grief, and especially around my journals. But I was incredibly angry. So, but I was angry at the automobile manufacturer who, it was a fault in the manufacturing, and apparently they knew about it, and that there are, statistics that showed that this car had this fault. But didn't take ownership and didn't compensate anything, and so I was really angry. But in terms of my relationship with God, I mean, it was kind of a question, because you always in the middle of grief kind of wonder, like, what is going on with this world? It's like a really screwed up hard place to be. And at that point my sense of God really was of this a sense of a being outside of myself. My sense of God has really changed since then, but there was one moment after the fire when I was out kind of walking through the hot ashes and looking for anything that survived. And I looked up and there were these five Norwegian pines that had surrounded the barn. And they were all seared up the insides. You know, they a couple of them burned their tops, but they're all seared up the insides of the trunks. And I walked up to one and it was just oozing sap out of the wound of the burn. And that image, or, you know, I felt so strongly in that moment that the tree was weeping, that the tree was hurt too. And that hit me really powerfully as kind of the sense of God or the divine or the universe accompanying me, being present to this loss and grieving with me. So that was a deep comfort to me at that moment, that it wasn't that God made it happen, or, you know, like it's just the world is set in motion and awful things happen. But I felt palpably the sense of grief and presence that was beyond me, that was part of the natural world, part of divinity, and with me through my grief. So today I would say that divine presence was, that I recognized in the tree, was also very much in me, that sacred part of the world always weeps at loss and always is angry at injustice and is with us in our anger and our sadness.
And people came through for you.
Yeah. Yep.
You talk in the book about books that people sent you, and there's a particularly moving passage about a pair of shoes that you received. So it's nice to hear that people came through for you. And that, I mean, I think that's sacred too. I mean, that is actually, absolutely, in my mind, how God presents God's self to me anyway, as other people. Yeah. How has your life, what has happened in your life since, I mean, I know this is a huge question, but I imagine there are a few special things that have happened in your life since the book was originally released that have moved you forward spiritually and changed you and caused you to grow and mature. What kinds of things have happened?
Oh gosh. Well, I got married. I fell in love, got married. My partner had a very serious form of cancer and almost died. And so we came through that illness together. We adopted a kid. She grew up. She's 13.
Wow, she's 13?
13, yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah, I've lost my parents. So yeah, lots happened since then.
What was it like to lose your parents? That's a hard thing, to become an orphan at middle age.
Yeah, it's a hard thing. Yeah, I'm still in that transition for sure.
You have taught and been a spiritual director. Are these things that you're kind of semi-retired from? What caused you to make that choice?
Yeah. So no, I'm still teaching right now. I'm taking a little sabbatical because I've got a big creative project. Actually, I've got two big creative projects in the work that need a little space. But yeah, I continue to teach creative writing, particularly as a spiritual practice. I'm really interested in revision and taking a project through many layers of drafts and how, as we transform our text, we can transform ourselves. So I'm less and less interested in writing for the sake of, or, you know, or teaching writing for the sake of only making art or only publishing and getting a readership, and much more interested in how a commitment to making art also is an opportunity for us to grow as human beings and become more fully who we are, to continue to come out, so to speak, into our true self. And so for me, teaching writing is really about a means of becoming more fully ourselves and also making manifest in the world around us our vision for it, for the world. So that intersection between what writing does for us personally and what it can do for our communities and our readership is really where I'm thriving. But I kind of like that trip in Wales. I think that early experience of retreat has taught me that it's important to step back and take time apart to regroup before launching into something else. And so I'm taking, I should say that I am still teaching. And in fact, I'm teaching an introduction to spiritual memoir this Sunday at Wisdom Ways. I'm sorry, this Saturday. And so it's not that I'm completely not teaching, but I'm not doing my regular classes for this next semester.
Well, I think we kind of finished up with this. We might have time for one more question after this, but this might be a big answer. I'm wondering, in this political climate, how you feel your memoir is relevant and can be of assistance to people at this difficult time.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's, I think, really part of the reason that I wanted to put it out again and why Skinner House agreed is that the political climate means that GLBTQA rights are threatened again, and the Christian right is very powerful. At the same time, there's a lot of people suffering inside of fundamental Christianity. And my hope is that the readers who are suffering, who are struggling with their sexual identity, can find a companion on the journey in this book, a loving companion that can uplift their truth and also perhaps proclaim a loving universe and a loving divinity that is, I think, quite contrary to the punitive God that is often taught in conservative Christianity. So yeah, I mean, I hope that it's a voice for a different way of being a faithful Christian.
Oh. This has been a wonderful interview. I am wondering if you're going to write another spiritual memoir someday.
You know, I'm sure I will. I've written lots of essays since Swinging on the Garden Gate that have a real strong spiritual memoir bent. They always include some memoir, although I tend to, when essays, be a little bit more philosophical.
You actually have a book that was nominated for the Minnesota Book Award. What was the name of that book? And
that's called On People... the... Yeah, that one's called On the Threshold. And it's a collection of personal essays, and that one's out of print, but you can get it through Amazon.
Well, this has been a wonderful interview, Elizabeth. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Jarrett Andrew, author of many books, including some books on revision. Before we go, talk about revision. I know you're a lover of revision, and you have two books about writing, and one of them is specifically about revision. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so the book is called Living Revision, A Writer's Craft as Spiritual Practice. And so revision is literally seeing again. And to me, that's what it means to be fully alive, is to always be seeing the world with new eyes. So I love revision because it's a craft practice that forces us to see with new eyes, and it gives us all kinds of exercise in stepping back and letting go of former ways of seeing things, and practicing new ways of seeing things. So that's a skill. I'm talking about political climates, I mean the capacity to question your own perceptions and your own meaning, the meaning that you put on your story, to kind of extract yourself from your own beliefs and call them into question and revisit them, and then take another stab at putting them together again. That takes a lot of humility, and I think that's a very important muscle for us to exercise right now. So that's why I'm such a proponent of revision, is because I think it exercises that muscle that makes us available for growth and better able to talk to each other you know, practice humility and take risks. So that's why I like revision so much, is that there's just all sorts of spiritual skill that comes, spiritual skills that emerge from the practice of revision.
If you had one big thing in your mind to say about Swinging on the Garden Gate, both the original and this re-release, what would it be? What can we glean from this book?
I think we can glean that matter and spirit are far more intertwined, or perhaps not separate at all than we imagine. That we tend to elevate spirit as kind of separate from the material world, but I think our essence is so intertwined with our bodies, and the essence of creation is so intertwined with the natural world that they're inextricable, and there's something very challenging and beautiful about that.
Oh, thank you for a wonderful interview. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Jarrett Andrew, author of Swinging on the Garden Gate, which has just been re-released. And now we're going to go back to Annie and do the calendar. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. It's good talking with you again.
Yes, it's good to talk to you too. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie. I'd like to thank Liz and our special guest tonight, Elizabeth Jarrett Andrew, and all our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio, and you can listen to all your favorite Right on episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now stay tuned for our good friends Bonjour Minnesota.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM Minneapolis St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org. It's where community grows.